Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome under the hoodies. As always, joined by Bill Kegel and Brian Shipley. I'm Mike Zeski. We're going to get right to it. We've got a lot to get to tonight. Start off with the recap of the National Championship game. Take a look at the seeding. Did the tournament committee get it right? We're going to address that. We're also going to talk a little bit of Major League Baseball. Pace of play in the discussion during the last week or so. And we're also going to give our predictions. Now, we're smart dudes. We wait about a week to give our predictions. That way we can eliminate some of those fringe teams who we think might be making a run. But let's get right to it, gentlemen. I'm sure we all watched the game. And in full disclosure, I did not watch the game Monday night. I DVR'd it and had to watch it on tape. A lot of ebbs and flows. And, Bill, I'll start with you. I think everybody going into this game really thought Kentucky was going to win. They were going to dominate on the inside. They were going to grab the rebounds. They were going to physically dominate UConn, and that wasn't the case. For stretches of the game, it was, but UConn prevailed, winning their fourth national championship. Bill, what's your overall take, not only from that game, but from an exciting tournament?
It's why it's the best tournament in sports. It's why it's the best playoff system in all of sports. It's just, you know, nobody had UConn. I mean, there's $1 billion on the line, and you know, for a perfect bracket, and obviously no one's going to get that. But there's no – UConn never crossed my mind when I was like, oh, who's going to be the national championship? Who's going to be the surprise team? Kentucky, I could see that. UConn never once crossed my mind. And for the game, looking at the game, I mean, if you take a peek at the box score, other than free throws, the game was pretty even, but in watching it, because I did what you did, I DVR'd it and had to watch it a day later. It did not look like a evenly matched game, even though the box score would dictate otherwise, minus the free throw. It seemed like Connecticut had the momentum and just the upper hand the entire game. I was surprised it was as close as it was.
Yeah, definitely. There were a lot of compelling storylines within the game, and Brian, one of them was UConn obviously getting out to the big lead and then Kentucky storming back when they switched to that zone defense. UConn didn't score. They were at 30 points with about 5 minutes left to go in the first half and didn't get to 40 until about the 12-minute mark. It was then when you really saw Kentucky's size start to prevail and you felt, all right, this is Kentucky seizing control, but that never happened. They never had the lead, and it was Napier's three and Giffey's three that really kind of distance themselves from Kentucky for good. Brian, I guess the question for you is, really, Napier obviously had 22 points, but they really didn't get a lot of contributions from other people. It was really a team effort. Hit 5 with 10. DeAndre Daniels was only 4 of 14. Were we looking at a truly great team plus one superstar, or were we looking at a collection of very, very talented guys who kind of underachieved during the season?
You know, Mike, I would not call them a great team. I think that before the tournament, it was easy to see that this was a really wide open field because there was a lot of very good teams, but maybe not that elite team. And I think that Connecticut fits right in that group of very good teams. You know, I felt like you made a great point a couple of weeks ago, not talking about UConn, but talking about Florida, about how their potential downfall could be poor free throw shooting and an inability to make outside shots. And I thought the inverse of that was true for Connecticut, and that's really what helped them advance was terrific free throw shooting in each tournament game and big outside shots. And I used to always think that, especially in basketball, defense wins championships, but there's just so many good coaches right now in college basketball, and there's so many good programs and so many good players that the talent level is really spread out, and there's just so many good teams. And I think that with all the good teams, you know, all these guys really compete hard on defense and play solid defense. And I think what separates a national title contender from a team that maybe gets bounced out in the first, second round, or maybe even misses the tournament, is the ability to make outside shots at crucial times. More so than any other sport, I think the college basketball is a game of runs. And having a guy like Napier or that other guard for UConn that – you know, their step-back move where they just open up just enough space to get off a long-range shot and make a big shot, that's the difference between not being able to score for very long or when the other team's finally starting to get close and then you make a big shot like that despite the opposition doing all they can on defense. You know, I think that's really what separates team. And the year before, you can look at Louisville and Michigan. Again, two teams that defended well, But two teams that shot the ball well from the outside, made good free throws, and had some good flow on offense. And then just to say, you know, kind of more specifically on the game, I thought that, again, the free throws are great, but I thought the end of the game strategy from Kentucky was just perplexing as can be. Under a minute left, they're down by four, and they're not in the bonus yet, UConn that is. And Kentucky chooses the foul, 22 seconds left, to get them one away from the bonus. And it's like, all right, you know, I would have preferred to see that foul right away with like 33 seconds left on the shot clock, not 22. But whatever, now they definitely have to foul again, make this a game of possessions. And I don't care if UConn's made as many free throws in a row as Jerry McNamara used to do for Syracuse. You got to foul and make them earn it at the line. And then for God knows what reason they didn't foul and then had just a colossal mistake by fouling with a couple seconds left on the shot clock. And then at that point, it's like, all right, you know, the game's over. And I know how difficult it is to make these decisions on the spur of the moment on the biggest stage. But at the same time, I just thought that was very, very perplexing strategy. And then, you know, ultimately, too, UConn out-rebounded them by one. And we talked about right. the size advantage and the athletic advantage that Kentucky had. And that really surprised me as well. And it made me wonder if a guy that I thought was underrated this entire season for Kentucky, and Willie Cauley-Stein, who missed the last few games with a high ankle sprain. And I wonder if his presence, you know, this is a guy who I think is underrated as an NBA prospect and will probably be a late lottery to early 20s pick. And you wonder a guy that gets 7 rebounds, 7 points, but really the presence down low, you wonder if he was able to play, if they would have been able to get just what they needed to put him over the top. But all in all, I thought it was a great tournament and a great championship game.
Well, I think you brought up a good point there about Willie Cauley-Stein. He gives Kentucky a lot more on the offensive end than Dakari Johnson does. Dakari Johnson is a terrible free-throw shooter. The entire Kentucky team was terrible from the line, 13 of 14 for 54% Monday night. But, Bill, I don't really know if that offensive punch really would have mattered because somehow, you know, we talk about this. Everybody talked about the size. Everybody talked about the strength in Kentucky. But somehow UConn, you know, despite getting in some foul trouble, and that really kind of derailed DeAndre Daniels, got him out of rhythm most of the game. Despite Kentucky's massive size advantage, Julius Randle only had 10. He only had 6 boards. Really the only guy that brought his A game was James Young. And Bill, I have to wonder if, you know, if this game is played, you know, best of 7, if Kentucky doesn't win the series. But again, that's the beauty of the tournament. It's a one-game scenario and anything can happen.
Yeah, I agree. I 100% agree. I don't know. I think I want to agree with you, but at the same time, it's just, even when Kentucky was making the run, it just did not seem like they could catch, for whatever reason, could not catch UConn. It seemed, like you pointed out, like when they switched to the zone and then they were, you know, they were doing a better job of defense, they still, for whatever reason, couldn't stop whatever UConn was doing completely, enough to at least catch them in the score. So I don't know. I don't know if I agree with that. I don't know if they would figure them out or what, or maybe, you know, Kentucky, if it was a 7-game series, being such a young team, would feel more comfortable going forward with that, because, I mean, Harrison almost had the turnover there at the end. That really could have killed him. So I don't know. I think I disagree. I think that UConn, I think if it is a best of 7, I think UConn would win and probably 6.
Well, they certainly had the best player on the floor in Shabazz Napier. There's no question about that. And it remains to be seen how his pro prospects will be. But Brian, I have a question for you. And I know you're big into the draft in both the NFL, NBA, et cetera. You're a big college guy. I was thinking about it today, and not based so much off of what happened Monday night, because I think DeAndre Daniels was a little overmatched by Kentucky's size. If the draft is held tomorrow, there's no question that Julius Randle has a better pro prospect and is drafted higher than DeAndre Daniels. I'm looking 5, 7, 8 years down the road. Am I drunk, or is it a possibility that DeAndre Daniels has a better pro career than Julius Randle based upon the fact that he can score, defend, and rebound, and he can shoot the ball from outside? Julius Randle can't really shoot, and certainly his defense has been come to question many times this season.
Well, Mike, if you are drunk, I would suggest not to drive because it seems like you might have had a few sips of whiskey today because I personally just don't see it. DeAndre Daniels, I think, is a real nice complimentary piece on a NCAA squad. And I think, you know, he has the length and athleticism. You look at the NBA, and he could certainly become a complimentary player there. But I still think Julius Randle is a far superior prospect today and in the future. You know, that said, I like Randle a lot. I don't love him. He kind of reminds me of Al Jefferson or Zach Randolph type. And I think 7 years from now we're going to say Julius Randle is one of those guys I call the Sharif Abdul-Rahim factor, that if you put him on a bad team, he's a fantasy stud, and he gets great stats, and he looks great on the back of his card, but his team is a perennial, not a very good team. And when he goes to a contender, you quickly realize he's a third, fourth option on a legitimate contender. But, of course, you know, it's simple supply and demand. There's not enough franchise players to go around in the NBA. So I think you'll see him make an all-star team for a schmuck squad a couple of years in the NBA and a really good statistical career, even though I don't think he's a franchise changer like you're hoping to get at the top of the draft.
I don't know. I like the guys that can do everything. And maybe I'm reaching, maybe I'm stretching, maybe I'm just, you know, trying to see something that isn't there. But I was really impressed with what he did against Iowa State, really impressed with what he did against Florida. And he never really, and I'm talking about Daniels here, he never really got into a rhythm against Kentucky because of the foul trouble. And maybe you're right, Brian. Maybe, you know, what we saw Monday night was a precursor of a potential NBA career for him because, you know, the size, he just couldn't compete. You know, he got in foul trouble, couldn't get in rhythm, anything like that. But, Bill, I want to ask you a question, and let's change gears now and talk about tournament seeding. When the brackets first came out, obviously, it was the major, I guess, injustice was Louisville at the four. And obviously, I think they could have been seeded higher. In hindsight, maybe they shouldn't have been. Kentucky is an 8 seed. A lot of people felt like Wichita State shouldn't have had to play them in the second. And I think people were saying that only because Kentucky played so well against them and then went on to the championship game. Bill, in my opinion, I think Kentucky was seeded just fine. They struggled down the stretch. They lost to a terrible South Carolina team. And the only reason they were saved and given the high seed as they were is because they salvaged it in the SEC tournament and almost beat Florida. In your opinion, Bill, was Kentucky seeded fairly? And I guess, was UConn seeded fairly given their regular season?
I think Kentucky was seeded exactly where they should be. I think you're right. I think they were lucky to have an 8 seed. I mean, if not for the SEC tournament, they would have been lower. UConn is probably seeded correctly as well. I mean, they got slapped by Louisville. They lost by, you know, 30-plus points to them. It was embarrassing. I really don't think they seed teams too low. I do think when they do the seeding, they tend to seed a little too high. I mean, it's kind of hard to argue Wichita State because of their record being number one. But I mean, really, are they a better team than Michigan? Or were they even better than Duke? Even though Duke got out in the first round, I feel like, you know, I think if they played in a neutral site, I think Duke beat Wichita State 99 out of 100 times, but yet Duke's a 3 and Wichita's a 1.
But Duke lost to Mercer, so everybody's like, oh, Duke, blah, blah, blah. But that's the beauty. Like, the tournament can only seed people based upon their regular season, and that's all they have to go by. And we all have perfect vision. Revisionist history is always going to be spotless if we say, oh, well, Kentucky made it to the national championship game, so the UConn, they should have been seeded higher. And, Brian, I don't think that's the case. That's unfair. But I think that reflects the kind of culture we live in. We like to point blame at people, and we always like to, you know, point out injustices when we can. The fact is they have an impossible job. Nobody's ever going to be happy. And in my opinion, they did a fantastic job.
I agree. I thought they did a fantastic job. And quite frankly, I think we were seated in 2014 and going into 2015 is about the most overrated thing we can talk about. The three-point line is the ultimate equalizer in the college game today, and it doesn't matter who you play anymore. All it comes down to is you might play a team that's an 11, 12, 8, 7, 10, whatever, and they might have a good chemistry, but maybe not as athletic as the higher seed they're playing. But all it takes is a couple of guys that are good shooters from the three getting hot in the game, and before you know it, a team's on the ropes, and they're playing at a neutral site, so naturally the crowd's going to be going and cheering for the underdog, and eventually that's why we see all these teams get upset over and over again, is that the tournament, to steal a quote from my man Billy Bean and the Oakland Athletics GM, the tournament's a gauntlet of randomness. I mean, let's be honest. These are all one-game sample sizes that are entertaining as hell to watch, but I really don't think you can draw too many conclusions based on what goes on in the tournament. Like, you keep hearing people say, well, guards win in tournament, well, this wins in tournament, well, that wins in tournament. And it's really just absurd. Like, yeah, the guards for UConn were terrific, but you know what? I saw them play in Buffalo against St. Joe's. They were down by three with a minute left, and St. Joe's had the ball. If St. Joe's closes them out there, we're not talking about guards winning. You know what I mean? I mean, it comes down to making plays at the end of tight games, which is certainly a skill. But again, in basketball, where one day you can go 3-for-20 from the field and have your worst day of your life, even if you're Kobe Bryant in his prime, and then the next day you might be 15-from-20, taking the same shots, same form, same everything. You know, I just think there's a lot of random variation that goes on, and there's really no conclusion you can draw from the tournament. But you know what? It's one of the most exciting months to watch. It's terrific to watch. You can make educated guesses of what's going to happen. But, you know, it really comes down to who's just the hotter team, the better team shooting that day, you know, who gets the more rebounds, et cetera, et cetera. So, like you said, I think that the committee did a wonderful job. It's really a fool's errand to jump into that job, because all you're going to do is get criticized. It's not good television for ESPN and Dick Vitale to say they got everything right. It was a terrific job. The committee does wonderful things. So I think that in 2014, you got to realize that everybody's good. There's really not that much of a difference between a 3 seed and a 10 seed, 7 seed, 8 seed like there used to be. So don't worry about your seeding. Just worry about your next opponent. Do what you got to do to win and be like UConn and just go one game at a time and see where it takes you.
Yeah, and these one-game elimination things, everyone tries to make it – there's, like, some kind of science behind everything, and it's kind of absurd. It's like, I mean, just as an example as well, the NFL playoffs. Both Super Bowls, the Giants won, and this is my weekly Giants segment here real quick. But every Super Bowl, the Giants won, they weren't supposed to. The Ravens weren't supposed to win the Super Bowl. You know, it just almost never breaks the way everybody thinks. I think this year in the NFL playoffs was the first time it broke how everyone thought it was going to break for the first time in years. And the same with the tournament. I mean, can you guys remember an NCAA tournament where everything that was quote-unquote supposed to happen actually happened? My best recollection, and I'm probably missing it, but is 2004 UConn team, which everyone thought was going to win, and then they ended up winning.
2003 Syracuse, where I knew they were going to go 6 in a row.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's fun. Yeah.
Well, I guess part of it, too, is you always talk about the NFL. I guess it translates, if you think about it, like a 6 seed in the NFL winning the Super Bowl. I mean, how similar is it how similar to what we saw Monday night, where arguably the 24th through the 32nd best team, somewhere in that range, was playing for the national championship despite having some terrible losses, despite stumbling for the most part into the Big Dance. I mean, where do we stand there? Are we okay with that happening? Are we okay with the randomness? Everybody's bitching about it, but in the end, we're all watching it, so people can't be too pissed about it. You know what I mean?
Right, and like I said, it's entertaining. It's heck to watch, you know, to watch. It's like watching a sitcom on television and getting good laughs, but then worry that there wasn't enough substance to the show afterwards. It's like, I mean, come on, this is the best way of doing it as far as these kids still being able to get to class, if they even do that anymore, who knows. But it certainly is a gauntlet of randomness. I mean, there's just not a conclusion that you can draw from a one-game sample size. There just isn't. Like, you know, I mean, these kids are human, they're young. One day they could shoot great, Trevor Cooney against Notre Dame. Another day he can look like he did against Dayton in the tournament. The other point I want to make is, you know, in these one-game sample sizes, a lot of it comes down to matchups, but not matchups based upon the number to the left of your name. I don't think we can say anymore, oh, well, this team's a 3 seed, this team's a fill-in-the-blank seed, clearly the 3 team better. No, I think it comes down to the particular matchups, where if you're a guard-heavy team that likes to shoot from a perimeter, well, it helps if you go against a team that likes to pound the ball inside and doesn't have very good guards on defense. Or conversely, if you're a team that likes to pound the ball inside and get your big men involved, and your next matchup's against a team that likes to play a four-guard offense and doesn't have a lot of quality big men, then that's obviously a plus matchup for your team. And I think the more plus matchups you get, based on the style of play and the type of personnel you have, the more likely you are to advance more than, oh, well, this team's a lower seed. We're ranked 10th in the AP poll. They're not ranked, blah, blah, blah. I just don't think that stuff matters anymore in 2014.
No, you're right. I don't think there's any algorithm for really any one-game tournament in at any level, at any sport. I just think it's who gets hot, who plays the best on that day. I mean, it's that simple. And the fact that everybody keeps trying to, I don't want to say waste time, because obviously they get ratings talking about it, but, I mean, it's just, I don't know. There's not a science to it. There's no science. There's nothing. The one thing I will say is that if you ever listen to Kevin Durant, there was during All-Star Weekend, there was an interview Bill Simmons did with Kevin Durant, and Kevin Durant sounded very, very ornery the entire interview. Apparently, he was, like, really tired or whatever. Boy, he perked up when he was talking about Kevin Ollie. So I don't know. I don't know if he had something to do with it, but all I know is that anybody that's ever met Kevin Ollie, Kevin Durant included, and I've heard a couple other people talk really highly of him, maybe Kevin Ollie is the science, at least this year.
I think the bottom line is, guys, nobody's ever happy with anything in this world. I'm a big How I Met Your Mother fan, and to me the ending was fantastic, and it's the same thing. You know, 9 years of greatness, and then the ending doesn't happen the way people like it, and everybody bitches about it. It's just the society that we live in. You guys are under the hoodies. I'm joined, as always, by Bill Kegel and Brian Shipley. Guys, we're going to switch gears now and talk a little Major League Baseball. Before we get into our predictions a week late, yes, obviously, we're going to talk about pace of play. And I don't know if you guys listen to Mike and Mike in the morning. Every now and then I'll tune in. Well, Mike Greenberg is always beating the drum about pace of play and screaming and whining and whatever, wearing his Gucci sunglasses or whatever the hell he does. To me, and Bill, I know that, you know, we've talked at length off the air about this. To me, the games they don't take as long as NFL games, yet the NFL is the most popular game in this country. Baseball is fine the way it is. You know, it's a thinking man's game. It's not see a target, hit a target like football is. It's a thinking man's game. It's very cerebral. It takes time. And there's way too much money on the line for there to be a shot clock for a pitch like Mike Greenberg suggests. Bill, I know you have some interesting thoughts, so hit us with it.
All right, well, first of all, I read something that said each NFL game plays about 7.5 minutes of actual football. That's 60 minutes of game clock, plus timeouts, TV timeouts, halftime, you know, switching sides of the field each quarter, but only 7.5 minutes of actual football is played. It is by far. If the NFL is Usain Bolt and I'm baseball, that's how far it is in a 100-yard dash away from the ratings. So I don't think it's that. It can't be the pace of play. I don't know what it is why baseball is not, you know, doing as well as – I mean, even the NBA. Game 7 in the NBA Finals, 26 million people watched Game 7 in the NBA Finals. About 7 million less watched Game 6, the deciding game of the World Series. I don't know why that is. The only thing I really got is I guess it's the younger people willing to stay up later and watch the game. But, I mean, I really don't have a good conclusion. Brian, what do you think?
Well, I'm going to go off on a little tangent here because this really, really grinds my gears when I hear this. And,
yeah,
you know, I got to say,
be angry.
I got to say, Mike Greenberg, shut up. I mean, that's just the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. And I'm just so sick of people beating the drum of baseball's losing interest, and it's a dying sport, and once the baby boomers pass, there won't be interest. It's like, do you guys pay attention? Do you ever read what's going on within the sport? I can make a strong argument that without a doubt, baseball is the healthiest sport when you look at everything out of all the major pro sports. Yeah, football might be more popular, more profitable, blah, 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 whatever. But guess what? Baseball doesn't have that black cloud that I like to refer to as concussions over their head. A. B, let's look at all the TV money that's coming in to baseball. I mean,
yes,
no industry has grown more in the past decade than baseball. payrolls and salaries are just astronomical. And there's no way that these television executives in all these suits are paying all this money to televise baseball games if there isn't legitimate interest in people watching them. And then my last point is baseball is never going to be able to market a sport like football, where Sunday night football, Monday night football, let's get the premium matchups. I have a favorite team in football, but I'm not going to lie. During the season, I just want to see the best two teams play. So, you know, for example, a few years ago when the Ravens and Steelers, when that rivalry was at its peak and the best rivalry in sports, if my favorite team was on at the same time as the Ravens-Steelers game, I was watching the Ravens-Steelers game because it was better football, better competition, closer score, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas baseball, I feel like a major portion of the fan base has a favorite team that they follow religiously. And it's really a wonderful feeling to be able to follow your favorite team from April to September, even though as a Cubs fan, usually by May they're out of the race. And I couldn't care less how long the game takes or what the pace of play is. The only thing I care about at the end of the night is that the Cubs get to raise the W flag at Wrigley Field. An example of this is last week they played a 16-inning marathon against the Pirates. And I was disgusted at the end of the night that they lost. But you know what? I was ecstatic. I was like, this is great. It's 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'm still watching a Cubs game on television. I mean, this is awesome. And some cold January night, I'll think about how nice that night was, even though they lost. And at the end of the day, I think baseball is just fine the way it is. Just leave it alone, and the fans will come back because it's one of the most beautiful sports in the world. And I think the older you get, the more appreciative you are of baseball. And as Mike said, it's the thinking man's sport. So those that don't want to think and need quick stuff and Twitter and this and that, go find a different sport. Just don't talk about it. Let's quit catering to these casual fans that really don't care about the game. And let's cater to the people that love baseball to make suggestions of how to improve it.
We might as well just end the show now because there's really nothing I can say or you can say, but let's get a topic.
There's not, Brian. The only thing I will say to you is that, if you're looking at ratings, baseball ratings are lower than meaningful baseball games ratings are lower than NFL and NBA, and I don't know if pay-to-play has anything to do with it. My theory is that when they're on, I mean, the game starts late, and you like watching till 1 o'clock, but a lot of people, you know, value sleep more than you and I think, and I think that, I mean, it sounds really simple, but I do wonder if that's the problem, or maybe it is the baby boomers. I mean, I don't know. I honestly sort of disagree with you, Brian, a little bit, because I just think the other sports, I don't know if it's the thinking, I mean, you can say the NFL is a thinking man's game. They're essentially playing chess on every down. So same with baseball, I guess, but I think, I don't know. I do think the common, because of Twitter, the instant gratification and all that, I do think that is why football and basketball tend to be more popular in meaningful games than baseball.
Yeah, that might be true, but guess, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mike, but real quick, but guess what? The big markets, if the Cubs are in the playoff race or the Boston Red Sox, the Yankees, and all anybody really cares about is these big markets, if they're in the race, the ratings are through the roof come September, October, November, et cetera, especially if you get a Red Sox-Yankees type playoff matchup.
And that's, and right, you're talking about...
Go ahead, Mike.
Hold on. Let me chime in. You're talking about, you know, you're talking about playoff races. You're talking about attendance. That's what the extra wild card does, guys. It gives teams that normally wouldn't have a chance at the playoffs a chance for their fans to come out and support a playoff team. And I'm going to give you some stats. They're from Forbes here. And talking about some of those teams that were right on the cusp of the playoffs, like the Cincinnati Reds, the Reds drew almost 2.5 million fans last year, establishing a new record for their ballpark. The Pirates drew 2.2 million, the most since their inaugural season in 2001. They had a single season record of 23 sellouts last year. Baltimore, the Orioles, even in the season they didn't make the playoffs, their highest attendance since 2005. And it goes on and on. Kansas City, second highest attendance since 1993. That's a team a lot of people think can compete. Bud Selig, you can hate him. You can talk about pay-to-play. The dude knows what he's doing. There's TV deals out the ass. And everybody, Miguel Cabrera, Clayton Kershaw, are signing multi-gazillion-dollar deals because of that TV money, because of that gate revenue. And that's a fact. And you know what? Mike Greenberg will talk about the baby boomers and how we, you know, baseball's in trouble 20, 30 years down the road. I couldn't disagree more. Those aren't the people we want to cater to. And, yeah, they may not want to watch. You ever been to a game in Philly? There's plenty of young fans there. You know, in these cities, it's a regional sport, guys. It's not a national sport like the NFL. In these cities and in these regions, the fans are there. They are rabid. And just because one guy who has a radio show thinks that they should put a damn shot clock for pitches is absurd. Absolutely absurd.
I couldn't agree more with you on that. That I am not defending what Greenberg said. He is a blowhard, and my personal hell is listening to him and Bob Costas talk about the Yankees for whatever reason. That's my definition of hell. So completely agree with that. So I want to clear that before I don't want you to think that me going against Brian, what Brian said a little bit was me agreeing with Greenberg. That's absurd.
And you know what, guys, and one more thing, winning does kind of dictate how your attendance will fare. And the Mets, obviously, their woes continue. A stat from Forbes, again, same article, the Mets were down 107,000 in paid attendance last season. The Miami Marlins failed to sell out a game. And the Phillies, a team who was contending for World Series 2-3 years ago, saw a 16% drop in attendance from 2012 to 2013. You guys are under the hoodies, as always. Bill Kegel, Brian Shipley, one of these times, guys, I'm going to get your names mixed up, and that'll be fun. I want to switch gears to something where we'll be less angry, predictions. Unless we all have the same predictions, we may disagree, we may not. And I don't know about you guys, but I think a lot of the division winners were clear-cut. Brian, I don't know if maybe that's just me seeing that, but I kind of feel like we're all going to have the same division winners. Definitely not World Series, but definitely division winners.
Yeah, I agree. I think you had a good point earlier about a possible sleeper team. One of my favorite sleeper teams this year is the Kansas City Royals. But I think you're right. If you look, I think really the only races that are tough to predict is going to be the AL West, maybe the NL East, and the rest of them, I think it's pretty – if I had to put money on it, I know exactly what I'm going to be putting my money on.
Brian, you don't think the AL East is kind of up in the air a little bit? You think the Rays and the Red Sox are? Do you think they're not as close as a lot of other people think?
I think if you would have asked me a week ago, I would have said that. But there's reports today that Matt Moore, a fabulous young pitcher for the Rays, has an injury that's usually a precursor to Tommy John surgery. And anytime you hear about a pitcher getting that injury, it's just hard to pencil him in anymore for 200 innings. I mean, again, if I was betting on it at this point, I would say it's more likely that he barely pitches at all this year. So I think if you would have asked me a week ago, I might have said that. But due to that injury, I think that now the Red Sox are the clear-cut favorites in the AL East.
Well, last year, didn't David Price miss a lot of the season with an injury?
Yeah.
And the Rays were just – I'm not saying that, hey, you know, just because they did it last year, you know, means they'll do it again this year. But I don't think there's a lot of people that would say Matt Moore is better than David Price or has more impact on that team. I wouldn't sell the Rays short. A lot of people had them as a World Series favorite coming into the season. I know Jason Stark from ESPN did. You know, obviously losing a guy like Matt Moore hurts, but I don't think it's going to cripple them to the point where they won't be able to contend for a division or at the very least a wild card.
Well, and I see your point there, Mike, but I think that what separates the biggest separator of a big market team to a team like the Rays that have to pinch every penny that they have is that the Red Sox just have so much depth right now. They're able to invest more money into their farm system. They have a lot of prospects on the verge of coming to the big league team and helping them out in case of injuries, poor performance, whatever. And I think that the other big difference is if the Rays lose a few more guys come trade deadline, the only way they're going to be able to go and acquire someone to come in and help them and give them an upgrade is if it fits in their salary structure. Whereas the Red Sox, not only are they flush with prospects to go obtain whoever is going to be the big fish this year at the deadline, but they can also take a guy that maybe is underperforming at a different place but would still be an upgrade, but maybe they just have to take on, you know, say $10, $13 million of salary and they basically get them for free. And a team like the Rays just don't have that opportunity. So I feel like it's like being a homeowner and one person's on such a tight budget that when there's one leak, they can fix it, but if there's five, they can't. Whereas a big market team and a rich person, it doesn't matter how many leaks they are, they're going to have the resources to patch them all up.
No, I definitely agree with that. So let's start with the AL East then. I mean, obviously, I don't know about you guys. I'm definitely – I think Boston – the only concern I have with Boston about winning that division is their struggles on offense. Everybody's a year older. I don't know if they can recapture the magic from last year, but I think their pitching is far exceeds any other team in that division.
I agree. I'm sorry, Bill. Especially the Yankees, too. I mean, their rotation depth is next to nil. And not to keep praising the Red Sox, but, again, the Red Sox have so many reinforcements at the high-level minors that can come in if somebody's underperforming or gets injured, et cetera, et cetera. And the Yankees, I feel like, are just such an old, aging roster of players that are on the wrong side of the bell curve of their careers. And I think that if any of their five starters gets hurt or doesn't live up to expectations, that they're going to have to throw replacement-level guys out there. And I just don't think that they have the offense like they used to cover it up. And not to mention their de facto ace, CC Sabathia, looks, you know, he's had a tremendous career, but he looks done like burnt toast in the oven, so, or in the toaster, excuse me. Well, what do you think, Bill?
No, I agree with everything you just said. I mean, I'm kind of now going back on my Rays thing after hearing the Matt Moore thing. I didn't hear that. So, picking right now, I definitely think the Red Sox, for all the reasons that you said, come out of that division. I am very, very – I'm out on the Yankees completely. I don't like any of the moves they made. I don't like the old players they brought in. I don't like Ellsbury's inability to stay healthy for extended periods of time. I think Brian McCann is probably the best move. Brian Roberts is he's like Matt Stafford in year one and two of his career. Guy who knows what we're gonna get with Tanaka. Are we gonna get Yu Darvish or are we gonna get Dice K? You know, it's kinda hard to tell. So if I had to put money on it right now and I was forced to, I would say Boston just because the Matt Moore injury sort of scares me. But Mike made a good point about David Price missing a good chunk of last season. But Brian, again, like you said, you know, they have to find replacement level guys to pick up that pace, and they can't afford to get anyone really worth even, you know, what part of Matt Moore is. So I think the Red Sox come out of the AL East.
Don't sell the Yankees short. Tanaka takes them on tonight. Perhaps CC will figure it out, but I'm not too concerned about Ivan Nova after last night. He'll be fine. He pitched very well in the second half of last season. And I think it's going to take a couple starts for Pineda to kind of recapture the form that he saw a couple years ago coming off injury. We're going to move to the AL Central. I'm pretty sure we all have the Tigers here. I'd be very surprised if either of you guys did not.
Yeah, I certainly have the Tigers.
Yep, Tigers as well.
I love how you guys both wait, and then you start at the same thing. It's fantastic radio, guys.
we're on the same wavelength, Brian and I.
That's right.
All right, we're going to move to the AL West, and this is, you know, we talked about it in the open. This is one of the divisions that I had a lot of trouble with. Given Yu Darvish and what they're going to get back with Matt Harris and Derek Holland, and that offense with Chu and Fielder, and a full season of Alex Rios, I don't see how Texas doesn't win the division, but I wouldn't be surprised if they finish third or fourth.
Yeah, I think that the Rangers always have a lot of talent, and I think more than other sports, baseball managers don't matter as much as, say, an NFL head coach, an NBA head coach, et cetera. But I do think that Ron Washington, strategically, even though he seems like a great man, is one of the worst managers, tactical managers in the game. And I feel like if there's a guy that can get a car on cruise control to somehow hit the guardrail, it's Ron Washington. So he certainly worries me, and I think he might be the thing holding him back. The team I would have picked, again, a few weeks ago is the Oakland Athletics. I love Sonny Gray. I love Josh Donaldson. You know, I like a lot of – I think that they're – maybe don't have any elite stars, but I don't think they have any scrubs on at any position either. I think that they just are solid all around. But, again, same thing with the Rays, a guy who I always feel is undervalued, not only in the league but in fantasy baseball as well, is my man Jared Parker, who went down with Tommy John surgery at the late spring. And, again, similar to the Rays, it's just hard for a team like the A's to find somebody or be able to acquire someone or take on more salary to fill in for but is really their number two starter. You know, they don't have
right.
the luxury of doing what the Braves did when their young pitcher got hurt and was out for the year. The Braves were able to spend $14 million on Irving Santana, and options like that just aren't available to a team like the Rays, so I worry that they're not going to have enough pitching. And a team that I would say to watch out for is the team that everybody's been waiting to take off in that division the last few years based on how much money they spent, and that's the Angels, because I feel like they finally reinforced their rotation with what I thought was a wonderful trade this year, trading Mark Trumbo, sort of a one-trick pony, for a few years ago. If you asked me what pitcher in the minor leagues I would most want on my team, I might have said Tyler Skaggs, and I thought he was a real nice pickup for him, and I can see him having a nice renaissance this year, career renaissance with Anaheim.
I agree with Mike as far as Texas. I thought it was a really, really kind of an underrated pickup by them is Tommy Hansen. Tommy Hansen, I remember when, and I know he hasn't pitched well as of late, obviously, but I just remember him on the Braves, and as a Mets fan, I was like, "Wow, this guy is super impressive. I mean, he could be the top of a pitching staff one day." And it hasn't quite happened for him. But I think being behind Darvish and some of the other guys Texas has in that offense, I actually think he'll sort of figure it out, and maybe find his way this year. But a lot of what Mike said about Texas, I mean, I feel pretty strong about them. And, again, I'm just going to kind of echo what Brian said about the Angels. I mean, maybe they figured it out. Maybe they spent enough money. I thought David Freese was a pretty good signing. And I don't know.
And Mike Trout, two words.
Brian, I think if Cabrera wins an MVP over Trout again, Brian might have about six new holes in his bedroom wall. So I remember talking to you about that, and you were livid. You're like, "Are you kidding me? This is the best player in baseball. They keep giving it to the guy with all the fancy stats." So if I had a pick, I would say Texas.
The fancy stats and who doesn't have a WAR of 1 million like Mike Trout does. The two wild cards that I have, I'm sticking with Tampa Bay guys. Again, they got it done last year without David Price, and they're going to get it done again this year. And I also have the Oakland A's, and I really hemmed and hawed here. I wanted to pick Seattle. I really did. I just couldn't pull the trigger. I just don't trust that lineup. Corey Hart's not going to hit two home runs every game. So I went with Oakland. So I had Boston, Detroit, Texas, Tampa Bay, and Oakland. Pretty standard across the board. I really, the only teams you can make an argument for might be Cleveland and the Angels, like you guys said. I'm just a little worried about their pitching. The Tyler Skaggs pickup is fantastic. Jared Weaver doesn't look right, and I just don't know what else they have on that pitching staff. And, you know, their bullpen is suspect, and we don't really know what we're going to get from Ernesto Friere, throughout the course of an entire season.
Yeah, I would probably go for my two wild cards, whoever doesn't win the AL West. I think at the end of the day, when push comes to shove, I probably would pick Texas. So I'd say I would have the A's as my top wild card. And then my second wild card is I'll go out on a little bit of a limb here, and I think it's going to be the Kansas City Royals. I think they've been gearing up for this year to kind of go all in, and I could see them making a splash to the deadline again if payroll will allow them to. And I just really like some of their young talent. And if you want a sleeper for second place MVP votes, because sort of like LeBron in the NBA, I think it's silly to give anybody the MVP other than Mike Trout every year. And I think it should be a race to second. And that's Eric Hosmer, who, again, a former top prospect that kind of had a little bit of a speed bump to the start of his career. But watch out for him. I could see him having the type of stats that gets MVP votes and being the type of bat that can propel his team into that second wild card spot.
Whoever out of Boston and Tampa doesn't win. So I'll say, I would say Tampa and Anaheim. I can't believe I just called them Anaheim. Wow. Too much Angels in the outfield for me, but the Angels and the Angels and the Rays. I can't really add anything more than I already have about those two teams, but I don't know. I like them both. And Again, we'll get the World Series predictions, but it might be one of those two teams.
What you guys know about Danny Glover and Angels in the outfield. We're going to switch gears now to the NL, And he was in that movie, right? I'm not just.
Danny
yeah,
Glover was
right.
in that
it
movie,
was,
and also the little boy that was okay. in that movie, the main kid, is actually a big star now. He's in a lot. Tony Ward Love.
Don't forget.
That guy. He was in he was the dude in Third Rock from the Sun, right? With John Lithgow.
Yep.
Yeah, that was
yep.
it. Look at Mike
yeah.
watching TV. This was good stuff.
TV, dog, not movies. TV.
Ain't nobody got
time for movies.
Hey, yeah. If we do have a chance at the end of the show, I do want to take back my my favorite sports movie thing from last week. If there's time, we'll get to that at the end. I just want to say it's White Men Can't Jump and not Varsity Blues. That's all.
You guys will be proud of me. I actually watched a movie the other night. It's from 2010. It had Steve Carell and Tina Fey in it. Couldn't tell you the name, but it was absolutely hilarious.
Oh, Date Night. Yeah, that was a good one.
Yeah. And it had Common in it. That guy has zero personality, but somehow he's a millionaire. Good rapper. We're going to switch gears now. You're under the hoodies, given our baseball predictions with Bill Kegel and Brian Shipley. We're gonna switch gears and go to the NL. I have the Washington Nationals, of course. Their starting pitching, their bullpen is phenomenal. The only concern I have for them is Ryan Zimmerman's health. The shoulder obviously causes him to throw the ball into the stands on regularity. You can't really rely on Anthony Rendon, although he's been stellar so far this year in the second half of last year. But, you know, point of diminishing returns at that point, how much are you really going to be able to rely on a rookie? All in all, the Nationals, in my opinion, probably run away with that division because I think eventually all the injuries to the Braves will catch up to them.
Yeah, I agree. I would say that the Nationals are the team to beat in the NL East. I saw Ryan Zimmerman make a throw the other day that would make Chuck Knobloch and Mark Wohlers blush, and that's really saying something based upon how
Mark
Wohlers ended.
Yeah, that was a dig deep there.
It was just awful, and I do not see how they can continue to trot that guy out to third base, and I'm wondering why, if I'm a left-handed slap hitter, I am bunting it towards him every single at bat and making him throw an accurate throw to first. I just think that their rotation is absolutely stacked. My sleeper for the – not even my sleeper. The guy I'm going to pick to win the NL Cy Young this year is Jordan Zimmerman, who I watched him the other night, and he was really, really stellar. So I think between him, Strasburg, and they basically should have gone to jail for larceny for stealing Doug Feister, a perennially underrated pitcher from the Tigers. And I think they're the best team. Even though I like the Braves roster on paper, I mean, these guys just strike out and strike out and strike out. In a one-game, three-game series, that's not a big deal, but I think over the course of a season, it's going to hurt their run total and make it difficult for them to keep pace with the Nationals.
Yeah, it's definitely the Nationals in the NL East. You pointed out about Doug Feister. I was livid. And Gio Gonzalez hit a home run off Bartolo Colon, so that's awesome. It's the Nationals, I'll just say right now, I think the Braves are going to be my pick for the wild card spot there. But I just don't, that's tough. Harang pitched really good the other night against the Mets in a loss. But it's a very tentative wild card pick for the Braves. I mean, I don't like anyone else really. As far as the quote-unquote sixth seed outside of them. But, I just want to also point out that the Mets, what the hell, Ike Davis hasn't been able to hit anything in 2 years, and then he has the freaking walk-off grand slam. I couldn't decide if I was excited or upset.
He looks different, man. He looked different at the plate. Like, he looks like it's a more compact swing now. There's less moving parts. He's not holding the ball. Holding the bat. What's that guy from the Tigers that pretty much used to hold the bat? Was that Mickey Tettleton? He used to hold the bat literally like at his waist. Yeah, he used to do that, but you can't do that when you're 6'8". So you just can't do it. He looked different. That's all I'm going to say about that. And Bartolo Colon looked like an ace, number one, we should pay this guy $20 million a year guy last year, and he's not that, obviously. That's how bad the Braves offense is. We're going to switch gears and go to the NL Central here. I like St. Louis. Their pitching is phenomenal. A lot of young pitching, too, so they can be good for years. The only thing that worries me about them, Brian, is offensive struggles. Matt Holliday's a year older. They don't have Beltran. A lot of injury questions there. Not really sure that they can come up with the magic that they did last year and get to the World Series, but I think they're pitching strong enough to win that division.
Yeah, and before I get to the Central, let me say that Bartolo Colon also looks like the left fielder on my beer league softball team. So props to him for staying in the majors for so long. As far as the Central is concerned, to make a cross-sport comparison, I think the St. Louis Cardinals are to baseball what the New England Patriots are to football, and they've just figured out the system to have a competitive and consistent winner year in and year out. And sort of with my point earlier about the Red Sox, I just think that the Cardinals have more depth than any team in baseball, where it's like, all right, we lose Chris Carpenter, he gets old, he moves on. Well, we'll just plug in Shelby Miller and his 95-mile-an-hour fastball. I mean, as a Cubs fan, it makes me so jealous. They're the Cubs' number one rival. But every year I feel like that they call up a pitcher from the minors that throws 95, has nasty stuff, and either gives them a major spark out of the bullpen or in the rotation. So I think that they're still the king of the NL Central. And back to what Mike said earlier about having an extra week gave us a chance to assess things and maybe pick apart teams. I think a week ago I might have said that I like the Pirates best in the division, but that was based on their young pitcher, Talion, making a major impact for the team probably sometime mid-summer. And unfortunately, like all pitchers are, you know, at the end of the day are ticking time bombs as far as injuries, and he too had to go under the knife for Tommy John surgery. So I think that big, huge reinforcement that could give him a major boost in the middle of the season, sort of like Garrett Cole did for him the year before, you know, that guy is gone now, and I got to think that if they would have known that, they never would have let A.J. Burnett go. So
yeah,
I think that puts them back a peg. But, man, that team finds a way to win day in and day out. And then I think the Reds are a close third. But at the end of the day, I got to go with the Cardinals.
Yeah, absolutely, with the Cardinals. Yeah, that's a great comparison, comparing them to the Patriots. I think that what Pittsburgh did last year was nice, and it's good stuff. I mean, can Liriano really throw, you know, a sub-3.5 ERA again this year? And you think I don't want to say caught lightning in a bottle last year, but I think the team might have overachieved a little bit last year. And in the Reds, I mean, I like Billy Hamilton a lot. I don't know if
you mean the Flash, not Billy Hamilton. You mean the Flash,
sorry.
Right?
Yes, that's what I mean. I'm sorry, the Flash. The Flash that that can get on base. But I do think it's a little absurd to say that he's going to steal 100 bases. I mean, when's the last time that was done? Did Ricky Henderson, was he the last person to do it? But even still, I really like the Reds other than St. Louis in that division. I just think the middle of their lineup is solid, and I just don't see the Pirates, you know, kind of maintaining what they did last year.
I'm going to skip the NL West because I'm assuming you all have the Dodgers. The only concern I have there is trusting that outfield. You're waiting for Puig to self-destruct. We're waiting for Matt Kemp to get hurt. Andre Ethier's never been a great player, and Carl Crawford isn't the guy to sign that big contract with the Red Sox. But I want to talk about the Pirates, a team, Brian, that you analyzed, and Bill, you apparently don't have a lot of faith in. You brought up a great point, Chips, with losing Burnett, especially now that they lose their young guy for 12 to 18 months. I think that getting so close last year gave them a taste of what it's like. I think they're veterans. McCutcheon's a year older. Neil Walker's hitting the ball a lot better this year. Pedro Alvarez is a monster. The pitching obviously scares me, and that's really what propelled them last year. Guys like Burnett, guys like Grilly in the bullpen, even though he got hurt, Melanson picked up the slack. Was that a fluke last year, those two guys, Melanson and Grilly? I don't know, can you expect them to do that again, Brian? I don't know if I'd bet all my chips on that happening. You know, even if they get, 80% of what they got from those guys last year, that's still pretty damn good.
Yeah, that's a great point. That the back on the bullpen really nailed down games. And as anybody that listens to the show knows, I watch pretty much every Cubs game, and they've already played them 4 times. And based upon what I saw, the stuff that, both Mark I always mispronounce his last name, so I won't even try. And Jason Grilly had last night. I certainly think that they're still going to be pretty lights out, especially Grilly, who still throws 95. Probably a little help from the HGH that his agent Gary Sheffield might be able to locate for him. But I think the reason that I really like the Pirates is not stuff that you're going to find in a box score. It's not stuff that you're going to look at for on the back of baseball cards. But I just don't even understand why more teams don't do what they do. Even though their manager, Clint Hurdle, isn't regarded as an analytical or stats guy, every single play they put on a defense, pretty much every single play they put on a defensive shift, and they have a lot of good defenders already on the roster, but they always put them in a position to make plays, get outs, and have quick innings. An example of this last night is Starlin Castro, who is the Cubs' most complete hitter, sprays the ball to all fields when things are going well for him. And for the first time ever, I saw them play a shift on Starlin Castro. So why would they do that? Well, because the stats show that this is the areas that he is most likely to hit a ball to. So why don't we put a defender at the exact position that he's most likely to hit a ball to? At this point, a backfire because Castro was able to find a hole. But I think it's just the little things like that of, you know, I think sometimes we get too caught up in scoring runs, and I think the Pirates do a great job of preventing runs and getting quick innings and allowing their pitchers to go deep, having guys in the right position, having plus fielders, plus defenders at every single position on the field. And I think that that's what really allows them to win a lot of these 3-2 games and one-run ball games. Good defense, good bullpen, timely hitting. It's still the best way to have a playoff-caliber team.
We only have about 3 minutes left, guys. A lot of analysis, great baseball analysis so far, and really what everybody wants to know, and I'm sure people across the globe are listening right now, to get our World Series predictions. I was way off last year, like many people were, by picking the Nats. But I'm hopping up on that horse one more time, and I'm picking the Nats to come out of the National League. Brian, who is your National League representative in the World Series?
I'm going to be boring. I'm going to go with the New England Patriots. The St. Louis Cardinals.
No, I'm with you, Mike. I'm going with the Nationals. I think their rotation is ridiculous.
And I think the Dodgers are a close second in the National League. In the American League, I really hemmed and hawed. I want to pick Texas, but given your analogy about Ron Washington steering into a guardrail on autopilot is pretty spot on. I'm going to go with the same prediction I had last year. I'm going Nats versus Tigers in the World Series. I just think that both teams have a phenomenal amount of pitching. I think this year, you know, Bryce Harper's a year older. Jason Worth really played well last year. Adam LaRoche is off to a fantastic start. And the Tigers, of course, they're a little older, a little long in the tooth, but that pitching, if you can go Scherzer and Verlander and then Anibal Sanchez, it's really hard to top in a five-game series, especially a seven-game series, where you might get both of those guys twice.
Yeah, I agree. I'm going to go with the Tigers, too, just because I think that their World Series window is shutting quicker than an open screen during a rainstorm in the summer. So I think that with Max Scherzer in a contract year and seemingly with stall negotiations, this is probably going to be their last year with him. With Verlander, Cabrera, Torrey Hunter, et cetera, getting older and older, I think you're going to see that team play with a real sense of urgency and concentration throughout the season and into the playoffs. And I think that's going to not only propel them to the World Series, but, you know, really give them a chance to finally get that title that's been so elusive these last few years.
Yeah, you know what? I'm going to blame karma for the Tigers not making it after paying paying Cabrera all that they're paying him 2 years too early to sign him. I'm going to go with Tampa Bay, even with the Matt Moore news.
All right, guys, 90 seconds. The lady in my ear told me. I'm going with the Nationals to win the World Series. The starting pitching, Zimmerman, Strasburg, Gio Gonzalez. You know, they fleeced Doug Fister from Detroit. The bullpen is phenomenal. Soriano, Clifford, Drew Storen. That guy could be a closer on any other team. I'm going with the Nationals to beat the Tigers, although I wouldn't be surprised at all if the Tigers won it. And, again, I wouldn't be surprised if the Dodgers took it down either. But I'm going with the Nationals as your World Series champs.
I kind of teased it last during the AL picks, but I'm going to go with the Tigers. I just think a 1-2-3 of Verlander, Scherzer, and Anibal Sanchez is very tough to beat in a seven-game series, and I think they finally get over the hump this year.
I'm going with the Nationals also. I think that the pitching, Harper will figure it out, get out of a slump, and I think they're going to win it.
Guys, it's been a lot of fun. For Bill Kegel, for Brian Shipley, I'm Mike Pazeski. You guys, join us next week for Under the Hoodies. This has been a
Fax Sports Page Radio Network production. We actually had time to say that, guys. Usually we caught it really close to the end, but I had time to get that in today. Guys, it's been fun. We'll talk to you next week.
Later, guys.